Morocco has become the Florida to which northern Europeans escape when winter comes. And Fez has become one of the great tourist attractions of Morocco. It is situated on the slopes of a high valley which reaches up into the foothills of the Atlas Mountains. When the French took over the governing power in Morocco around 1911, they had the good sense to build a new city of Fez a few leagues to the west of the old city. And over time, the old city has been cleaned up. The rubbish has been cleaned from the streets. The streets have been washed down. The stench, the odor of a North African city has largely been removed from Fez. And the beauty of some of the medieval architecture remains, and so it has become a place where European and other travelers can walk safely into the antique glories of a North Africa that never was. North Africa without the crush of humanity, without the unspeakable poverty, which was part and parcel of life there for many, many centuries. Fez, the old Fez, was founded in the year 1809. It was founded by one of the dynasties which arose in Morocco, claiming descent from Muhammad, founded by a man named Idris, who was able to establish his authority over much of what the Arabs called the Maghreb, the West. Same word as the Hebrew word, Ma'arav, in the 8th and 9th centuries. It's interesting when you think back on it how much geography, at least nomenclature, is determined by where we stand and who is the imperialist power. We call Israel one of the Mideastern lands because it is east of England where the imperial power lay 100 years ago. To the Arabs, North Africa is the Maghreb, the West. It's west to them from their power base in the Arabian Peninsula. In any case, Jews came to Idris's capital at the very beginning. They were needed. There is in the Arab world a feeling that to work with one's hands, particularly to do artisan kinds of work, goldsmithing, craftsmanship with leather work, metal work, this kind of thing, is beneath the dignity of a man. And so in order to have the craftspeople who were necessary for his city, he imported as his population, the base population, Berbers, some of the indigenous population, and then Jews. And he probably found these Jews among communities which had lived in the area of Fez for perhaps 1,000 years or more. The settlement of settlements in the Fez area are very old. Archaeologists working in the nearby city, Roman city of Volubilis, a few years ago, found an old Roman graveyard. And in that graveyard, they found an inscription in Hebrew, which said essentially, "Here's buried Matrona bat Rav Yehuda Nach." Matrona, the daughter of Rabbi Judah Nach, may she rest in peace. And they also found in an older layer of the cemetery, they believe that the inscription comes from the 3rd or 2nd century of this era. But from somewhat earlier times, they found a number of those small clay Roman lamps, which are often put in and near graves, which were incised with the 7-branched menorah, which was the sign of a Jew, the sign of the great candelabra which burned in the temple in Jerusalem. And no one was surprised to find evidences of Jewish settlement in Roman North Africa in the Fez area that early. In fact, it is generally believed the Jews came much earlier than that. The indigenous population are Berbers. No one quite knows where the word comes from. They apparently are the remnants of a European people which moved down across the Straits of Gibraltar in prehistory sometime way back when. And they spread across all of what is today Tunisia and Morocco. And then beginning in about the middle of the 2nd millennium before the Common Era, peoples from the area of Sidon and Tyre, these cities which have been so much in the news in recent years, Phoenician cities, began to establish trading centers along the littoral of the Mediterranean in Libya, in Tunisia, in Algeria, and in Morocco, and to spread their economic and then their political influence inland until, for all intents and purposes, North Africa became an independent Phoenician empire. You may remember when we studied Latin way back when in high school, we were told about the Punic Wars, which were the early wars fought between the Romans and the Carthaginians, as they were called. Now, the word Punic is simply the anglicized word which the Romans used for Phoenician. These are the Phoenician Wars. Those who ruled in Carthage were Phoenicians. As a matter of fact, the foundress of Carthage is said by legendary history, and perhaps by history, to be a woman by the name of Dido. And Dido was the sister of the famous Jezebel, about whom I read to you this morning. They both were the daughters of the king of Tyre. And when one was married to Ahab, the king of Israel, the next door neighbor to Tyre, the other was sent to the west, to Carthage, where she, in the name of her father, established the great Carthaginian empire. And it was an empire which contested with Rome for the domination of the east of the western Mediterranean. You remember Hannibal crossing the Alps with his elephants and coming down upon the city of Rome and almost capturing it. And Carthage was the great foe of Rome until the year 148, before the Common Era, when the Roman legions were able to conquer the city, and then they leveled it to the ground and sowed it with salt so that it would never appear again on the face of the earth. So the Romans then followed the Phoenicians into the area of the of North Africa. But the Phoenicians had brought there already a Semitic tongue, Punic, Semitic forms, forms not unlike those which were practiced in early Israelite times. And it would have been very unlikely had Jews and Israel, Judeans and Israelites not come along with these Phoenician sailors, traders, and colonialists as they began this, what was for after all, 1,000 years of interpenetration of North Africa. The Jewish communities in the area of Fez and Morocco during Roman times were small, but they continued to thrive. Jews seem to have spread throughout the area and to have had some major success in converting to Judaism the Berber tribes, particularly those who lived in the high reaches of the Atlas Mountains. One of the reasons that we know this is that when the Arab armies began to spread across from Libya to North Africa, beginning that great sweep that they entered into in the late 7th and early 8th century, they were met, as they began to attack in the North Africa area, by a confederation of Berber tribespeople led by a Jewish queen, a woman named Kahina. And this confederation, which was led by Kahina, was able to keep off the Arab invaders for 5 years. And for at least that period of time, she, her Judaized tribespeople, and her non-Judaized tribespeople controlled the entire North African area. And then, of course, since the late 7th century, the Islamic power has been the dominant power in that part of the world. Now, with the establishment of Fez, Jews moved into the city. The city was the great cultural and as well as economic capital of that whole area. And there were Jews who were very successful and very useful to the powers that be. The bulk of the community were shopkeepers and small artisans. The North African community has always been a community where the majority of the Jews who have lived there have been poor. But because Fez became, in a sense, the Oxford or the Cambridge of the Arab world in North Africa, particularly in the glory days of the early Islamic spread, the great madrasas of the Arab world drew a kind of cultural life to which Jews responded, and some of the great schools of the Sephardim, of those Jews who lived in the Iberian Peninsula and in North Africa, were established in Fez. And these schools specialized in grammar, lexicography. And we know that there was a man named Judah Ibn Quraysh in the 9th century and another man named Ibn Dunash in the 10th century who were the two men who more than any others established the scientific basis of Hebrew grammar, and so enabled us to really scientifically, analytically translate the Torah and the other Hebrew texts. And perhaps the greatest of the literary figures to come out of Fez was a man named, whom we call Al-Fasi, Isaac ben Joseph of Fez. He was born in the early 12th century. He died in the early 13th century. He was trained in the schools of Fez, and then he went and lived in Lucena in Spain, where he became the greatest Talmudic rabbinic scholar of his day. His great law code was one of the great literary monuments of rabbinic studies and remains so to this day. He was a teacher of Judah Halevi. He was a teacher of the father of Maimonides. His influence spread far and wide, and Fez was looked upon as one of the great centers of Torah. But it was not just this, the glory days of Fez, as far as the Jewish community were concerned, were not destined to last very long. In the, just about the time of Al-Fasi, which means he who was born in Fez, that is in the 12th century, in the early 12th century, a group of Berber tribesmen, newly committed to Islam, spread their power and their zealotry across Morocco and then across most of Spain. They're called the Almohades, those who affirm the unity of God. And in their zeal, they gave to all who were dhimmis, that all who were tolerated infidels within the Muslim world, Christians, Jews, and others, they gave them the choice between death and conversion. And the Christian communities were absolutely destroyed, eradicated forever by the attacks of the Almohades. The Jewish communities, who were somewhat larger, either went into exile or accepted a great bloodletting, or many of them converted, at least temporarily. And finally, a few years after the first spread of the zealous crusaders, who were, in a sense, the Muslim response to the Christian crusaders and their zealotry, who had moved down into Spain from France and Northern Europe to begin that great crusade of reconquest, which was to end in 1492 with a total elimination of the last Muslims from Spanish soil. When the Almohades' zeal began to run out, they allowed many Jews to revert to their original faith. The king recognized that the conversions had not been meant, had been forced and coerced and had not been meant. But something new had been introduced into the life of the Jews of Fez and the rest of North Africa. And that was simply that they were now the only identifiable minority in a Muslim ocean. And one of the truths about minority life is simply this, that you are much better off if you are one of a number of minorities than if you are the only minority. One of the reasons that minorities have done so well in the United States is that when the know-nothing groups, the populist groups, the Klan types come to the fore, they have so many enemies, Catholics, blacks, Jews, American Indians, Vietnamese, that it's hard for them to concentrate their hate, their venom, on any one target. But when, as in Europe, the Jews were the only infidel, the only non-Christian minority, or as in Morocco, they became the only non-Muslim minority, a fact which did not occur in any other Muslim area. The Jews in the East were always one among a number of minorities, Parsi, Kurd, Armenian, Coptic Christian. There were always any number of other groups. But in North Africa, the Jews were the only target. And as North Africa fell from prosperity into poverty, which is to say, as people no longer needed to use the caravan routes which had brought prosperity to North Africa, they now went by sea. North Africa lost its preeminence. Someone needed to take the blame. And as she slipped into poverty and slipped into ignorance, the more fanatic of the Muslim leaders began to preach fanatically against Christians, against Jews. When Christians disappeared, simply against Jews. And Jewish life became something that it really was did not become in other Arab lands. The Jews became scorned, spat upon, abused, and we suffered all of the disabilities that one can possibly equate with being a pariah nation. In the 15th century, a mela was established in Fez. There'd always been Jewish quarters. There were Jewish quarters throughout the Arab world, throughout most of the world. That's simply people of like, who share certain identities, live together for various reasons. But now Amela came into being, which is simply an Arab ghetto. No longer simply a place where Jews happen to live, it's a walled-in place with a gate. And the Muslims control when that gate is open and when that gate is closed. And the gate is locked at curfew and not open till the next morning. And from the 15th century on, the Jews of Fez were not allowed to leave the Mela wearing shoes. When they were outside the Mela, they had to go barefoot or to wear sandals made of straw. Inside the Mela, they could dress as they wished. Outside the Mela, they had to wear black clothes. In the Arab world, the widow wears black. Black is a symbol of being without anyone protecting you. It is you're utterly dependent upon the goodwill of others. You're exposed. And Jews had to wear the black, the color which signified their helplessness and their exposure whenever they were outside the Mela. Now, in Fez, as in most of these cities, those who ruled discovered that the Jews could be very useful to them. They could be useful to them because the Jews depended upon their favor. The Jews could not be accepted by the population at large. Therefore, they were not a threat to the power of the emir or the caliph or the sultan or whoever was in power. And they could be used for the most awful tasks that no one else would undertake. They could be used to raise taxes. They could be used to expropriate property. They could be used to collect debts. And whatever monies the Jews had could easily be taken from them, because all you had to do was to send the janissaries into the Mela and say you'll be killed unless whatever monies you have are made readily available to the king. So the Mela in the Fez was right up against the palace wall. The Jews were not allowed to be part of the larger community, and they were kept close to the palace wall because the king, for his own purposes, wanted to protect the Jews from the wrath of the mob so that they could do his dirty work and they could be fleeced whenever he needed to fleece them. And so the life of the Jewry of Fez was one where every 50 years or so there'd be what we would call today a pogrom, a bloodletting. The mob would break into the Mela. The king at some point would, after the mob had satiated anger, would send out the troops to protect those who did his dirty work for him, and Jewish life would continue to survive as best it could. The Jews were better off in the sense that they were lit. Most of them were still in those days literate, above an illiterate Muslim mass, Berber mass, but they had no rights. They existed on sufferance, and they became deeply embedded with most of the superstitions and the ignorant practices of the Berber Muslim mobs and masses among whom they lived. And then in the late 15th century, a great immigration occurred. One wouldn't think the Jews would want to come to Fez, the kind of Fez that I've been describing, but it's all a matter of perspective. And in March of 1492, you'll recall, just before Columbus sailed for America, Ferdinand and Isabella, under the pressure of the church, published the edict, which said that in all of Spain, the 600,000 Jews of Spain had three choices, and they must take one of these three choices within the next 90 days. They must either leave, or they must convert, or they must submit themselves to be executed. Now, there was no place in Europe to which these Jews could go. Many of them fled to Portugal. But Portugal put on an order of expulsion very similar to the one in Spain in 1498. It only gained for them 6 years. And the closest land they could get to, which was Muslim, was North Africa. And the richest city in North Africa was Fez. And so as many as could make towards Fez did so. And though they were fleeced and things were taken from them, and many were bruised and killed along the way, 20 or 30,000, a great number for that day, found their way to Fez, and found that when they got to Fez, the last thing the native Jews of Fez wanted were the Jews of Spain. They feared them. The Jews of Spain had a higher culture. More of them were literate. They treated their women better. They were used to authority. They were members of a middle class, and most of the Jews of Fez were of the lower classes. And so the Jews of the Mela locked the gates of the Mela against these Mugurashim, as they were called, those who had been expelled. And they live for a while in a temporary, what we would call a DP camp, a displaced person camp, outside on the plain, outside of Fez. But the ruler of Fez saw the advantage of bringing in these Mugurashim into his mila. They were talented. There were some physicians among them who could cure his illnesses and those of his family. There were people who were international traders who knew how to bring commerce into the area. And he forced the mila to open its gates and to bring the Mugurashim into the community. And this drama between those who were called the Toshavim, the older settlers, and the Mugurashim, the new Sephardic elite, was repeated over and over again in all the cities of North Africa. And it's very much in some ways like what took place here in America, when the older population, the German Jewish immigrant group, was suddenly faced with the in-migration of a new culturally distinct group from the Eastern Europe. The difference being that in America, the Central European group was already more Europeanized, more part of the modern world, of the higher, in quotation marks, cultural level, than those who came straight out of the crowded Jewish communities in the shtetls of Eastern Europe. And here, the people of higher culture were the new immigrants. And since the 15th century, the Sephardim, those who came from Spain, have by and large been those whose families provided the few Jews who rose to positions of rank, who rose to positions of wealth in the various communities of North Africa. And the Toshavim, the older community, became the proletariat, became a mass of Jews who suffered poverty, cultural degradation, cultural deprivation, and whose lives hardly testify to those values which we would like to associate with Jews. The Sephardim brought with them a great interest in Kabbalah, in mysticism. Now, on one level, mysticism is a very high and sophisticated kind of theosophy, of a theological philosophy. It was a way in which an impotent community, the Jews, could feel that they were still significant to the world. And the basic myth behind Kabbalah on that level is simply this, that at creation, something went wrong. And somehow part of the Shekhinah, God's glory, God's presence, escaped into matter and was imprisoned by matter. And redemption can take place only when God is, in a sense, returned to the fullness of his power. And when his power is complete, then he will be able to bring the Messianic age. His power will not be complete until all these sparks of the divine are somehow freed from the shells in which they've been enclosed out there in creation. And the only way to break open these shells is through the prayers of Jews. And so Jewish prayer, done by those who were expert in prayer, done with kavanah, with special kinds of Kabbalistic intent, was the ultimate conduit to salvation, not only for the Jewish community, but for the world. And they went on from that to speculate on the nature of God and the methods of creation. There's a highly sophisticated, highly intellectual theosophy, which you can read if you wish to read, but it is interesting in its erudition, but not necessarily relevant to the truth. But on a much lower level, Kabbalah was simply magic and superstition. The world that the Jews of the Maghreb, the Jews of Fez, lived in was surrounded by evil spirits, surrounded by jinns. And you needed to know all kinds of incantations to keep the plague away, to keep the enemy away, to protect your wife during childbirth, to make sure that your child would not be jumped on when he left the mila on his way to some one or another of the tasks that you set for him. And so the reading of the Zohar, which is the sacred book of the Kabbalah, which was written in Spain in the 13th century, became really a religious act, second only to the reading of the Bible among the Jews of the Maghreb. And you'd find in Fez the last 20 years, you'd find small chavurot, small groups of Jews who would in succession read from the Zohar from beginning to end without ever breaking the reading. The reading would go on day and night, hour after hour, one reader supplanting the other. They didn't necessarily know what they were reading, but the reading itself was a shield about the Jewish community. It summoned God to shield Israel from its enemies. And you would find that almost every act by someone who lived in the Maghreb was surrounded by the saying of formula, by turning to holy men or holy women to protect the child, to protect the woman, to protect the marriage, to protect the bar mitzvah. It was a world full of what we would call superstition, full of all kinds of acts designed to prevent the evil eye, designed to prevent the wrong and harm from coming to the Jews. It was also a world where the life of the woman was hell itself. In the traditional rights of women in the Talmud are limited. The woman is not to participate in the leadership of the Jewish community. Her testimony is not to be taken in a trial. She's not she's a suspect witness. Her life is separate and somewhat unequal. But under the influence of North African Berber and Muslim life, that unequality was exaggerated. Now, in Europe, the polygamy permitted in Talmudic law, in biblical law, was mitigated by a takana, an ordinance passed by certain Rabbi Gershom in the year 100, which prohibited for the Ashkenazic Jews anything but monogamy. The Jews who lived in Spain had been deeply influenced by their monogamous neighbors to the north, and the rabbis had found a variety of ways to almost impose monogamy on the Sephardim of Spain. They wrote clauses into the ketuvot, into the marriage contracts, which made it economically ruinous for men to divorce their wives. But these were new legal paragraphs, and they were not common in the ketuvot of the Jews of Fez, the Jews of North Africa. And though polygamy was not common in North Africa among his Jews, what we might call successive polygamy was the order of the day. A man would marry a woman, I almost said a girl, and most of the early marriages were with very young girls, 9, 10, 11 years of age. And he would tire of her, and he would divorce her, and he would marry another woman. And this might go on time after time after time. One of the men who is now the vice mayor of the city of Jerusalem is a scholar and historian of North African Jewry, himself a North African Jew, a man named Andrei Shuraki, writes in a book called Between East and West that he remembers meeting in one of the melas a woman who had been divorced 18 times. The rate of divorce among Jews in North Africa and in Fez was greater than the scandalous rate of divorce among people in the United States. A woman had no alternative. Once she was divorced, and by Jewish law you can divorce your wife for any reason, she had no way of earning a living. She had nothing to fall back on. There was absolute and abject poverty in most of these melas. So she could only get married again. And she was ultimately dependent on the goodwill of the man whom she married. And if he tired of her, she didn't produce a son, she was summarily divorced. And she would remarry as often as she could until her looks deserted her, and then she became a beggar in the streets. It was a sad, cruel world. A world which knew criminality, it knew prostitution, in which the sense of family, which we assume so basic to Jewish life, was to a very large degree bleached out of Jewish life. And if one ever wants to see the results of cultural deprivation, one has only to study the sociology of Moroccan Jewish life or the life of the Jews of Fez over the last 200 or 300 years. Now, in the 19th century, as Europe began to be more and more interested in other parts of the world and to spread its cultural attitudes, the Jews were attracted to everything that Europe had to offer. There was obviously nothing in Fez that could attract them. And so they were among the first to learn French. France was the country that exerted the great cultural influence in that part of the world. They were the first, if they were fortunate enough to be able to do so, to send their sons to France to school. They were the first to become the agents of French traders throughout that world. And they began to move from this dark medievalism, from the ignorance and the poverty and the disease which was typical of their lives, into the modern life sometime in the 19th century. Morocco was the last of the countries to come under European domination. Tunis and Algeria came under French domination several centuries before. But it was not until 1911 that French gained control over the area around Fez. And the Jews had a very brief period of growing prosperity, where they began to shake off the medievalism which had been so much a part of their lives. A very major role in this was played by the Alliance Israélite Universelle, the French version of our Council of Jewish Federations and Welfare Funds, which was the organization of Jews in France who provided monies to set up schools in the major mellahs of Africa, of Morocco, in order to train youngsters in the skills which were necessary in the 20th century to teach them to read and write a modern language. And there seemed to be hope for the 250,000 Jews of Morocco, for the 20,000 Jews of Fez. But then in the 20th century, that hope was aborted by the rise of nationalism. The Jew had, because of his thirst for escape from the dini status, from ostracism, from being a pariah, in a sense had thrown in his lot with a colonial overlord. And as nationalism began to come into play, chauvinism began to be felt throughout that part of the world, the Jew was seen by the new nationalists as part of the enemy of the colonial power, rather than the 2,000-some-odd-year-old native that he in fact was. And along with the rise of nationalism, as had been true a century or two before in Europe, there was a search by the locals, freedom fighters, if you will, for their ethnic roots. There was a reassertion of fundamentalist Islam, particularly as Islam felt itself threatened by modernity. You had a version of what you've seen happen in Iran, what you're seeing happening in the Lebanon today. And Jews began to be pressured in Morocco. And although they were much more deeply integrated in the life of the average Moroccan community than in other parts of the Arab world, and though the political issues raised by the creation of the State of Israel were much further away from these Jewries than they were from the Jewries of Syria or Iraq or Egypt, once the Second World War was over, the leadership of the Iraqi community, of the Moroccan communities, recognized that their days were numbered. And you began to see a major exodus from Morocco, which went on throughout the late 40s and 50s and 60s. So today the city of Fez, which once had about 20,000 Jews, may have 200. Morocco, which once had 250,000 Jews, probably has 15 to 18,000 Jews, largely centered in Casablanca and Rabat. A great Jewish community in terms of size has been decimated. Many of them went to Israel. Many of the upper class Jews went to France, to England, and to these United States. Interestingly, the first Jew ever elected to the Senate of the United States, a senator from Georgia by the name of Yuli, was a Jew of Moroccan ancestry, one of those sons of the favored families, the few who had managed to survive in that very difficult world. So the richer Jews came to the West, the poorer Jews came to Israel, the least educated. Many of them came from small mountain villages where whatever they had of schooling was simplicity itself. Their synagogue was a mud hut. And in Israel, because Moroccans had learned with great difficulty the law of survival in the ghetto, and that is that you fight back and you don't ask questions, there came to be early on a phrase, Morocca Sakin. If you find a Moroccan, you'll find a knife. In European Jewry, a question was raised during the Second World War. What would have happened if the Jews had been more vigorous, militant in their self-defense? Over the last 300-400 years ago, in the same way that ghetto dwellers in the United States have become more militant in their self-defense, the Jews of Morocco had taken to, if they were attacked, to finding a way to gain revenge. And of course, as is true here, most of that bloodletting ended up being against their own. And that it was unsuccessful in its larger impact. But it was a Jewry which was conditioned to respond angrily to attack. It was a Jewry conditioned to be devious, to be overly shrewd, to suspect government, to know that if one spoke the truth, this truth would be used against one. And so lying was a way of life because it was the only way of survival. And Israel has had a very difficult time over the last 30 years or so in adjusting this Jewry to an open society, a society where government is not the enemy, and where truth speaking and truth in one's business relationships is a requirement, and where one can trust the police to enforce the law and one doesn't have to be a vigilante to do it oneself. It is to Israel's credit that the acculturation of the Moroccan Jew has gone as far, it has been as complete as it has. It's one of the unsung, little-told success stories of social work, government policy. He took a Jewry that had been degraded and debased beyond any that existed on the face of this earth. And this Jewry has been brought into the 20th century, has been educated to skills required by 20th century life, and has become today a productive and important part of the Israel polity and Israeli economy. Of all the Jewries that are old, most of which have been decimated over time, the only one I think we can be grateful has, in a sense, disappeared is that of Morocco. In its place, surrounded by inhospitable neighbors, in a world where it was the only alien force, it is unlikely that this Jewry would have been able to come around into to develop the skills and the attitudes necessary in the 20th century. Why have the few Jews who've remained in Fez remained there? They've remained there because they are by and large the well-off community who has special commercial interests which are necessary to the state, or because they are the poor and the aged who somehow believe that there's no place else where they can ever find roots, or because they are the ultra-Orthodox who believe that Israel was established by a secular power and that Israel will not be secure until the Messiah comes and the Messiah does his work. In any case, it's a history of a community which proves that given what any other Jewish community has had, the Torah, our traditions, our set of values as they existed over the past, that even the best of communities can over time be brutalized and criminalized and reduced to beggary and superstition if the pressures are constant enough and if the conditions are unfortunate for a long enough period. It's a sad story, but one that needs to be told. Amen.